Right now, it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. Of course, David joins us on a Friday morning, and he's also got his own website, themediabeat.us. You can also find him as a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and right here on Robin Hood Radio. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. Welcome. I'm at least I hope I'm welcome with you, but I'm saying welcome to you in my new little world. I'm not reporting to you from the media capital of the world. I'm reporting to you from another capital of the world, I guess the entertainment capital of the world. I'm out here on what they call locally here the best coast. I'm in Los Angeles, and I just want to crow a little bit the fact that I'm up earlier than you, and a very rare thing.
Well, you are seeing
it's 4:33 for me, and 4:33. Well, 7:33 for me. So let me just get one little bit of one-upmanship there.
Wow. And for people who don't know, it's a big difference when you broadcast from the West Coast and you're used to broadcasting from the East Coast.
Okay. I'll say. I don't propose to make a habit of this.
it could be worse. Someone's got to do it, right?
I'd prefer to do it from my home city.
All right. Well, you know, we've always heard the term, growing up, the world is getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And damn, you look around, you look at the political strife in this country, you look at the elections, the European elections, the political strife there, and you flip over to Israel, and you see the political strife that is going on there.
Political strife is so severe that even that master of political survival, Benjamin Netanyahu, is having trouble forming a government. I know it's never been easy to form a government in Israel, but there's a man who's been in power longer than you can possibly imagine anyone being governor of, being in charge of a country like Israel, which is a small country, but very, very factional and very difficult to rule. And now, only a month after victory, finds himself in numerical victory in an election, unable to actually form a government and going back to the country again and saying, let's vote one more time.
Well,
it's pretty remarkable, and another sign, of course, of just how hard it is to rule over Israel.
But you look all around, and it's the world.
Oh, it's
really
not alone. Israel is not remarkable to that degree. A lot of places look as if they're very difficult to govern too.
The most stable. It appears this is terrible. It appears the most stable governments are the governments like in Russia. I mean, they're the only real stable governments. I mean, Germany is fairly stable, but Europe has its problems, and of course you look at the United States and it's just a mess. What's going on here? Just a mess.
Well, somebody once said that democracy is wonderful, but it is it's messy. Let's put it that way. And we go through phases. We go through phases of greater messiness sometimes, and now and again we have peace and orderliness. People get very misty-eyed now about the Eisenhower years, don't they? Though I suspect if we were living back then, we might find that it was very turbulent in many ways too. I mean, there were lots of tensions at work in the Eisenhower years too, and I think if we were reporting then, we wouldn't be quite so dewy-eyed about it as we are now looking back on it.
But I guess what concerns me and what should concern everybody is that you want as a former world leader, the United States really did move things along, and now. The group that's taking over really that role is not Europe. It's not even Russia. It's China. China has really become almost the go-to country now.
Well, it's not that much of a surprise. I mean, it is the most populous country in the world. I mean, what is extraordinary about China is the advances that it's made so fast. And of course, I'm not trying to make an advertisement of any kind for totalitarianism, but of course, it's easier for a company, which is a country which is totalitarian, to reorganize its economy and make vast strides forward. The human cost of that, of course, is not to be tolerated in a democracy. But yes, it was inevitable that China would get a grip on itself with. And they stood some pretty good chances of success, given their sheer size and the size of the population, of course. So it may not be what liberal democracies want, but China is the biggest, and I suspect inevitably. I may be wrong here, but it seemed to me inevitably that they would come to dominate the world eventually.
You know, I was years ago, as Hong Kong was being set to be handed back to China, I was golfing at the Hotchkiss Golf Course, and I was golfing with the parent of a Chinese student and a woman who owned a very successful business in Hong Kong. And I asked her, I said, do you fear the Chinese, taking over, taking back Hong Kong?
Mainland Chinese.
And she said the following. No, because Hong Kong is a cash cow. And if you look at the rise and the technological rise and the building rise and everything in China, it really does almost correspond to when they took over Hong Kong. I mean, it was absolutely, it's been amazing what's happened during those years.
Well, yeah. It's easy to turn them into a sort of booger bear of some kind or some bogey. The current American administration is demonizing China in many ways and turning them into a vast threat. Just because a country gets economically powerful in the world and has ambitions doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a danger. It depends entirely upon how other countries respond to it and what kind of relationship they manage to establish with it. The tariff war is not necessarily the best way to respond to a growing country that is flexing its muscles. There is a long tradition of there being a multipolar world, globally speaking, and historically speaking. You can treat a big country like China very differently if you have a series of alliances and you have that wonderful art form practiced fully, the art form of diplomacy. It's worked in the past to keep the world in a reasonably settled state for periods, and it could work again. The trouble is the cast list at the moment doesn't include so many people who want to practice that form of diplomacy.
No,
and since we are still in many ways the world leader, the United States, that is, and we seem to be abandoning the responsibility of taking a reasonable and diplomacy-based approach to other countries who are, have ambitions and strength and strength in numbers, especially, not treating China in a way that is necessarily going to achieve the desired aim of a balanced and safe world.
Well, it was interesting you bring that up, and because it's obviously Donald Trump does not like diplomacy that much, but loves. Look what he's doing with Mexico now. He's putting a tariff on Mexican goods at 5%, which could go to 25%, and he wants them to stop the immigration to the United States. We used to work with countries on that and not use a tariff as a baseball bat. Teddy Roosevelt didn't go around the world with the baseball bat that said tariffs. It seems like we're not in the business.
Well, he did carry a big stick.
Yeah.
Yes, he did. He spoke softly and he carried a big stick.
But there was also diplomacy.
But there was also a functioning. going back to your earlier points about the reason that it was impossible to form a coalition in Israel, the reason that it was impossible to get Brexit through, is that people have figured out that it's really you can block anything.
Obduracy does work. Yeah, yeah, right.
It totally works.
And so, in many parts of the recent elections all over the world have been showing that. Protest votes seem to be very much clearer than votes for things that people positively want. It's very much easier for a populist to declare what it's against.
But sooner
and, all the threatening and blustering at international level, at leadership level, is prone to the same problem. You can tell people what they must stop doing. But you can't make them do what you want them to do.
And so, in
terms of using tariffs as a way of threatening Mexico to come into line and do more to stop migrants coming over the border between us, well, I think a lot of realistic people's reaction to that is, well, good luck with that.
Exactly. See how that
works out.
But with what both you and Jill said about populism, and here's the whole thing about populism, sooner or later, anybody can put a stop to anything, but sooner or later, you have to deliver something different and something different that works. And if you don't, then there's big problems. And that's what worries me ahead in the world. There's a lot of people in politics now all over the world, which want to tear down politics, tear down what's going on. Like Steve Bannon, destroy it. Turn it to rubble. Well, then, if you don't turn it back around and do something with it, worldwide, there's going to be big problems with the financial markets and with the economy sooner or later, because you just can't keep saying no, 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 and then not deliver something that's different and that delivers something better.
Well, what is interesting is, of course, the whole group of people. Speaking of populism, all right, you know what the Bilderberg Conference is, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you never really read anything about that except in places.
One does trouble.
Oh, no, but really, I have watched with interest how yearly secretive meeting, usually in the Daily Mail, possibly in the Sun. You don't see anything really about it in the big, what should I call it, non-tabloid formats.
That's true.
And
like the Sun Valley Conference, all these sort of elite right. gatherings go on, and sure, there are meant to be oases of quiet contemplation of the world's realities, but of course they're human events as well, of course, and humanity will always out, I think.
One can only hope, but back to this. Obduracy and how it is making from a top line, from an external, because, and this is going straight back to the media and my just at this juncture chronic lament, it's making totalitarianism look efficient. And
I think this is where Marshall was starting. I think, unfortunately, in some ways, totalitarianism is efficient. I mean, that's one of its horrible attractions. And for a short time, at least, it can look as if it's making progress.
No, Marshall is Mr.
The human cost of that is just not to be tolerated by people who want a liberal democracy.
And this is what's really interesting. Marshall is not like that at all. Marshall.
Oh,
is,
I know he's not a totalitarian.
I am.
you are.
It's a terrible thing to say, but just in terms of efficiency, when we are trying to.
Are we talking about him behind his back? Is he listening to us?
He is right here, and I'm not even looking at him because I don't want to see his face. But the point is, his tolerance level of reasoned and even unreasoned debate and the fact that everyone should have a say and everyone is far more developed than mine will ever be if I got hypnotized, brainwashed, and spent the rest of my life working on it.
Well, I would say thank heavens for extremist Democrats like like Marshall. Yeah, you can take democracy to a great extreme, and I think in a way we should. I mean that essence of it that we tolerate, even the wacky and the dangerous is the essence of democracy. But it needs to be tempered, and it's like the old thing of. You are allowed a voice. That's the point of democracy. But there are limits on it. You're not allowed to shout fire in a crowded theater.
But
and the like.
Here's what's wrong with the democracy in this country. I will take the Democratic National Committee and bring them front and center.
I only got 12 emails yesterday.
But the whole thing about the Democratic National Committee is, whose fault is it that there's 20-some people running for president of the United States on the Democratic side? It's the Democratic National Committee's problem. There's nothing wrong with people running for president, and there's nothing wrong with setting up rules how people get into debates. But when you make those rules and you bend those rules so it benefits people, and it's to the detriment
right,
of other people.
Putting your thumb on the scale, is the very antithesis of democratic procedure. Yeah.
And they're doing that again with the debates by saying, okay, by the second debate, you need 250,000 followers and X amount of donations. And by the third debate, it should be the debates should be wide open in the beginning. And I think the only thing, and this is where the Democratic National Committee just doesn't get it, is that, you have to take people's, I'm not going to call them poll numbers, but how people affect the general public. That's the way you're going to find out after your first debates. But once again, last time they put the thumb on the scale solely to the benefit of Hillary Clinton. This year they're putting the thumb on the scale because they know that Bernie Sanders is going to be there at the end because he gets $20 million a month from his people month in, month out, so he's got the staying power. So now they've got to put their thumb on the scale for the people that they want other than Bernie, which is Harris, which is Biden, and then you've got the other side. But once again, they're putting their thumb on the scale, and people know it, and it's the easiest way to lose an election is to upset the people in your own party.
Yeah, the easiest way to lose anything is to do the same thing and expect a different result. But I am baffled by, no, and this is to your point exactly. I'm just curious.
But it's not only in this country. It's in England. It's in Germany. It's all these places. There's the thumb on the scale has riled people up, and they just don't want to take it anymore.
Quite right, and that is what happens when you have actually sensate humans running around who have their own lives that function and then listen to the press, quote, tell them what is going on, which is only what certain factions want to be heard. I'm sorry to sound like a tin-hatted person. It is a giant, what do you think is going to happen? There was, if I could, my computer just decided to update itself, but I saw in a newsletter this morning, UK, shock poll. It's only one, but it really looks like the people aren't going to go back to just conservative and Labour when asked to vote. You know, danger, Will Robinson, you might actually get the Brexit bloody party.
Well, it may be the end of the traditional two-party system in Britain. It may. For the reasons that you're talking about, people don't like being taken for granted and don't like having the scales thumbed, as it were, the thumb placed on the scale in a way to rig things. And if the suspicion is that the institutions are rigging our democracy, then there's going to be, inevitably, and for that reason, as well as a whole host of other reasons about resentment, resentments of all kinds, then you are going to get a protest vote. And that will you know, fall into the category that a lot of the messiness that we've been talking about falls into, which is the rise of the ethos in politics now, generally, as well as in the tech industry. That awful phrase that sums that ethos up is move fast and break things, and that's the response of many in electorate right now, and we're seeing it in a good many places. Regrettably, I think, but I think, and also I think it's almost inevitable given the way that things are going, and I suspect it's a wave that is washing through the world. It's a kind of a wave that will crest at some point and be followed, I suspect, by a wave of a different kind. But I could be very wrong there. We may be going all in the same direction I'd like to think not.
What's interesting here is that it sounds like I'm just solely criticizing the Democratic National Committee. I'm not. The Republican Party will never, ever, ever be the same after Donald Trump. It'll never
be reaping this harvest. It took a whirlwind of a harvest for a long time after Trump. Sure.
I think that even no matter what happens with Donald Trump in the future, there's now that 35 to 37% of the American populace that he has melded together. They, I do believe, are going to form another political party. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I don't think they're going to go back to the standard Republican Party. I think the Republican Party will eventually, once again, be taken over by the strong conservative side and not the populist side. But that will leave a good chunk of 35% of their party going someplace else. The Democrats, they just eat.
They just
eat their own. They don't have to. They don't have to worry about anything like that. But I do believe the Republicans do have something to worry about.
So basically,
in 4 to 6 years.
So basically, what you are saying is that this is another opportunity to not be a two-party system.
I think it's going to be forced upon everybody.
This is what David was saying about UK.
It's like Bernie Sanders supporters and Donald Trump supporters. They stay with their pick no matter what.
And there's a basic rule of politics, though, that it's just you just keep going long enough and something else will happen, like someone will die or it will change.
That is a very basic rule.
No,
something else will happen
and you just keep it going until that something else happens. And as long as you control the information outflow, you know, and you can basically keep your people happy unless you have to send it back down, if you will, to an election, and then bad things happen.
But in our last few minutes, I would like to address what the media is doing with the circus in Washington right now and get both your inputs on this.
I wanted to talk about the spelling bee. But go
well,
on.
Well, one is a priceless ocean. What's the right word? Right, it's a priceless oasis in our democracy, the spelling bee, and on the other hand, Washington is a sort of apotheosis of the swamp that our nation has sort of become in politics.
So we'll do Marshall first, and then maybe I'll get in the spelling bee. Just the way that they solved that, and just how wonderful and how smart those kids are. It's just fantastic. And I went to bed thinking, great, we're going to be, it's just like we can, we're
going to
be fine.
One of the things about the spelling bee, and I speak as an immigrant now, an immigrant from a pretty literate nation on the whole, compared with what, in a way, the view that nation itself has of America. We don't generally think of America as a highly literate nation. It's a prejudice common to many Brits, I'm afraid. But what's been amazing about the spelling bee is to see how it's covered in Britain. They're suddenly waking up to the fact that Americans appreciate intellectual competition and a kind of erudition. It's a very strange kind of erudition. We're rather puzzled by the fact that you want to make spelling some sort of marker for excellence, but why not? I mean, the Brits are almost proud of the perverse way that they spell everything. But it's remarkable how they suddenly decided that this is a kind of example of American heroism almost. And it's splendid for me to see as someone with a foot in both camps.
Well, I just being told that sadly we are out of time, but.
Well, next week we have the delight of Trump visiting England, so that's something else for us to look forward to next week.
Yes, laughing now. Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, the Media Beat.
Will you laugh next week? Goodbye and thank you. Bye-bye.
Of course, you can hear David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat on Fridays here on Robinhood Radio, also on the weekends and also after our noontime break. And, of course, all the time at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, click on David Tereshchuk, the Media Beat.